whenever we would go on a car trip, they'd say, "We're lost." And I would say, "No, we're not. We're having an adventure." Of course, we were lost.
Linda Ellerbe is the author of many books, including one called Take Big Bites, Adventures Around the World and Across the Table. Ellerbe talked to Anne Strainchamps about her edible journeys across the globe.
If you go to a foreign place with your heart open and you're ready to meet different kinds of people and see what their lives are like, one of the fastest ways to do that is to try the food. It's also, by the way, other than the sense of smell, which of course is connected to food, and music, a taste of something will take us back to a place in time faster than anything else. So I take a bite of my mother's recipe for fudge pie, and all of a sudden I can be 10 years old again in my mother's kitchen with my mother still alive. I can take a bite of a dish from Italy at a place where I got to know the people that ran the restaurant, and all of a sudden I'm there again. And this becomes part of the journey. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, too, is because since 2001, it has bothered me so much that so many Americans have stopped traveling overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, either I'm afraid to go or they don't like Americans there. Don't be afraid. I urge people not to be afraid. In fact, I do a lot of my traveling alone, and I feel very strongly that if I'm to be bound by a cage, let it be the natural limits of the planet and not my own cowardice.
Well, for example, shortly after 2001, you wound up going to Afghanistan. I mean, that's one of the trips you write about in the book. Tell me something about that one.
Well, we went there to produce a show for Nick News, for Nickelodeon, about the kids of Afghanistan. And we get to this place, and, you know, this country's been at war 29 years at that point. So there's not a kid in the country who's ever known peace. They don't have schools. They don't have books. They didn't have access to paper. Of course, they had no television, no computers. But they had more hope than any kids I'd ever met. They just blew me away with their internal hopes for the future and what they wanted to do and what they wanted to do with their country.
How did you see that?
So I ended up writing about that.
What would they say that made you think they had a lot of hope?
Well, they would talk about, and they would say, "I want to be a teacher." And these were girls who had been prohibited by the Taliban for going to school at all. Or they would say, "I want to be a doctor so I can help my country grow. I want to be a civil engineer." And they would say, "We're looking forward to when we can go to movies." Mm-hmm. And I would say, "What do you want to see?" And they would say, "Oh, Van Damme, Rambo, Arnold." And I would think, gosh, maybe we could export another kind of movie.
When you think of Afghanistan, what kind of taste comes to mind? Is there a taste that just sums up Afghanistan for you?
Well, there is, and it's kind of an odd story. We were in a market, and the producer of the show asked me to go buy some oranges and just walk through the market. He needed a shot of me walking through the market. So I bought a sack of oranges, and I was immediately surrounded by children. And I did what any decent human being would do. I reached in the bag and I began to hand out the oranges. And what happened was I created a riot. The grown-ups ran over the children and sort of squeezed me into this mini mob. They weren't trying to hurt me. They wanted the oranges. They were hungry. Well, the producer got very angry because they had to come in and, you know, sort of haul me out of the center of this mob. But the recipe at the end of that chapter is, buy a bag of oranges, give them to people who have no oranges. And every time I bite an orange, I think of Afghanistan.
That's nice. What about the trip you begin the book with, or the trip that inspired the book, your trip to Vietnam? And that was another kind of politically loaded trip, right?
Well, it was. I mean, the embargo had just been lifted. I went, and I mean, this is a country, you know, that resonates very high in the memory of people my age. I took my son, who was 25, and then there was another fellow that we met who was an ex-oral surgeon with the Navy, and we were in Da Nang. He had been stationed there, and his job was to identify American soldiers by their dental remains. And I had protested the war, he had gone to the war, and my son was born in 1970. So we came at it with three different viewpoints. And the chapter is called The Prism of Memory. And we get to this country where most of the population is under 25. and they have no memories. And they're all smiling at us, and I keep thinking, why are they smiling at us? Don't they remember? And then the next day was Liberation Day there, you know, and they mean liberation from us. And there was a big parade, and the veterans marched, and suddenly I found Vietnamese with memories. They weren't smiling. But, you know, we all see the world through the prism of our own prejudice, our own past. It's like trying to say, as a journalist, that you're objective. No one is objective. You bring to every story who you are, what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've read. So what you try to be is fair and honest. Every time when I first got to Vietnam, I would see people working, and all I could see were, you know, television images of villages burning or the last flight out of Da Nang with people who'd tried to hang on to the undercarriage of the airplane falling one by one into the China Sea. Now I saw this country that was trying to catch up with the present very quickly, and I hope that they can do better than most of Indonesia, which is caught up with the present at the expense of its ecology entirely.
How did that make you feel? I mean, as a former, you know, war protester, somebody who had thought the war was terribly wrong, to go back and see Vietnam almost as though the war had just never really happened.
That's how it was. It was almost like time traveling back to 1948. You know, I had thought the war was wrong. I still think the war was wrong. I thought the Vietnamese people were wonderful and interesting and welcoming. I enjoyed talking with them. One of the things that I guess I'd forgotten was how beautiful Vietnam is. It is spectacularly gorgeous. And if one is going to go there, one should go soon, because every year it becomes more commercialized. But in the end, when I came away from it, and I pulled out of Vietnam on a ship, and a woman came up to me, an American woman, and she was standing next to the rail, and I'm looking at this beautiful country, and she says, such a poor country. And I said, yes, it is. And she said, well, you'd think that we Americans would have kept a base here. And I turned and I looked at her and I said, ma'am, we lost this war. And she looked at me and she said, well, in that case, a small base.
And when you were a teenager, you worked as a missionary in Bolivia for a while. Is that where you...
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah. Is that where you developed your first taste for street food?
Yes, it is. And, you know, the name of that chapter is called Whatever You Do, Don't, because when I went down there, my mother had given me this list. Whatever you do, don't drink the water. Whatever you do, don't eat the street food. Whatever you do, you know, don't do this and that. Of course, I did everything she said don't do. And my breakfast every morning would be to go out and buy from a street vendor a salteña, which is the national dish of Bolivia. And it's a little like an empanada, a turnover filled with raisins and meat and olives. It's wonderful. And you bite into it and the grease goes right down you. And I would eat guinea pig in the markets, in the villages. And I thought, you know, I thought this was just wonderful. And it was my first real experience of being away from home. And my mother had set me off with so many rules. And so, by the way, had the church that sent me down there for its student missionary program. At the end of my year there, they changed the rules for the student missionary program and basically said, no 18-year-olds from Texas who drank, smoked cigarettes, would eat guinea pig, thought Indian healers might be onto something and thought Che Guevara was interesting, need apply.
In other words, we can't have another one like her.
Exactly.
Well, the last chapter of your book is called The River of No Return. Can you tell me about the trip that inspired this chapter?
Last summer, for my 60th birthday, I followed the Thames River, or the River Thames, as they say in England, from its source to the sea, 200 miles alone with my backpack, to celebrate turning 60, or as a friend says, in denial of it. And I had wonderful adventures.
At the end of that hike, I think you write that you had some bad news.
Yes. I looked at this hike as being a thing of, I was going to be in this wonderful sort of Zen state the whole way. And it didn't start out that way at all. I was filled with monkey brain, you know, that chatter in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little overweight. And, well, for example, I got lost following a river twice. I fell into the river twice. And I had scheduled 20 days for this 200-mile hike. And I finished 2 days early. And I was so angry at myself. I went back to my hotel in London And I called my office, and my assistant said, I have some bad news for you. Julia Child died today. It's a measure of my self-absorption that the next words out of my mouth were, oh, don't be ridiculous. Julia and I share the same birthday. On Sunday, she's going to be 92. I'm going to be 60. We always exchange cards. How can she possibly be dead? Well, of course, she was dead. And that was, it was this moment that changed me. I sat and I thought, and I had gotten to know Julia. Not only had she, you know, helped me along with a nation of young people learn how to cook, but we were both breast cancer survivors, and that's how I'd gotten to know her. And her attitude about that was, pick yourself up off the floor and soldier on and don't whine. And here I'd whined my way across half of England. And I thought, Julia wouldn't have done that. What can I do day after tomorrow to celebrate my birthday and hers, even though she's not here? I got on a plane the next morning. I flew to Italy. And at 6 o'clock at dawn on the morning of Julia's and my birthday, I was floating on my back in the Mediterranean, tasting water, the best food of all. And suddenly the James Taylor song, The Secret of Life is Enjoying the Passage of Time, came into my head. And I realized that what had been wrong with this whole hike was that I was afraid of turning 60. I was afraid of getting old. James knew the secret. So did Julia. And now I know it. The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time. Well, the alternative, you know, the lack of alternatives clears the mind wonderfully. So I had a grand birthday.
Linda Ellerbee is the author of Take Big Bites, Adventures Around the World and Across the Table. She spoke with Anne Strange Chimps.